You know, the online world is great for so many things. It's great for making you laugh, it's great for entertainment, and every now and again you come across ideas or people that literally blow your mind. But I still think some of our best thinking happens offline. So join me, Nessa, on Offline Thoughts as I chat about some of the things I think about when I'm not online. I'm really glad you're listening, and I hope you enjoy the episode. So in today's episode, we're back to my favorite obsession recently, which is Tesla. I want to talk about why I think Tesla as a company is like 100% toast. Toast in the sense that, like, looking back 5 years from now, 10 years from now, they're not going to occupy the level of financial powerhouse that they have right now. They're not going to be like a top 10 organization. They're not going to have anywhere near the valuation they have right now. It was valued at like 1.7 trillion. It's down to 800 billion. And I just think it has like a significant level to go before it's where it's going to end up. So I think it's toast from the perspective of, it's just not going to be a financial powerhouse, and it's not going to be like a company that people cite as being at the foreground of technological innovation with like years and years and years of growth ahead of it. Toast from that perspective. I also want to talk about why I think retail investors are still investing in Tesla, because one of the most confusing things that have come out of this is that despite like the spades of negative publicity that have come out around Tesla, around Elon Musk as the CEO of Tesla, like retail investors like can't get enough of the stock. So I'm going to talk about why that is, or why I think that is. And then finally, I'm going to talk about why retail investors, as opposed to institutions, are ultimately going to be the group that are left holding the bag, i.e. the group that's going to experience the like the largest losses amongst all parties involved. First, though, a couple of definitions in case like you're not typically into financy stuff. The first one is retail investors that I'll use a lot, and it basically just means people who are trading using their own money. So as opposed to institutional investors, where you have individuals that work within a massive investment bank, for example, using that institution's money to trade, retail investors are using their own money. So money they get from their work, so their savings, or money they get from like inheritance, like money that's their own, basically. And institutions or individuals that are trading within institutions are never taking a personal risk, because the money they're investing is not their own money. It's basically their company's money that's usually pooled from like a whole bunch of different types of investors in that institution. So in terms of like risk profile, clearly retail investors are always going to be at higher risk because it's their own personal wealth that they're risking, as opposed to institutional money, where the people within those organizations are using the institution's money, and that institution, the money isn't usually their own anyway. It's usually been pooled from various sources. The other definition is shorting a stock. So it's the opposite of just traditional like stock buying. So usually if you believe that a company is going to go well, you buy shares in their company. So you might look at a company like, let's say McDonald's. Let's say you think McDonald's is going to do very well, or is going to continue to do very well, or perform better than it's performing right now. You might like go onto whatever platform you buy stock on and buy shares in McDonald's. And then you would hold on to those shares for a period of time with the hope or anticipation that it's going to go up in value. So if like in like 6 months' time it goes up, then you've made the difference between what you initially invested and the profit that you've seen over that 6 month period. So that's like traditional, just like buying and holding stock. So shorting is the opposite of that in a way, whereas instead of you betting or hoping or anticipating that the company is going to do well, you're basically like anticipating that it's going to do like worse than it is today. So if you think that McDonald's future isn't bright, or they're not going to do as well as they're doing right now, you would basically short the stock. So you would buy a stake that bets that they're going to go down in the future. So you would make money if the share price went from like, I don't know what the actual share price is, but let's say the share price is $10. If it went down to like $8, that's how you make money, versus the traditional buying and holding, where if it went from like 10 to 8, then you would have made a loss. So retail investors, shorting, and the rest is pretty like simple stuff I'll be talking about. Now, before I just start on my first segment about why the end is nigh for Tesla and maybe Elon Musk as the persona that we know him as, is that like this whole saga has been a reminder that wealth or being born with money or being rich, like, does not equate to being smart. Because even on a basic level, for those of us who haven't taken like a business course, a business degree, or an MBA, like, even we can see that choosing to align yourself with a voting base, i.e. Trump's voting base, that doesn't believe in the climate crisis or the climate catastrophe, doesn't even make sense from Tesla's own interests, because Tesla's model relies on us believing that our consumption of fossil fuels has contributed towards like the release of greenhouse gas emissions that are contributing towards major disruptions in the environment. And so Tesla, as a solution to that, is supposed to give us an alternative to cars that use fossil fuels. So instead of you buying like a traditional Mercedes or Volkswagen that uses petrol or diesel, i.e. fossil fuels, if you believe and support the idea that we need to do something about the climate catastrophe, then you would buy an electric vehicle that doesn't use those fossil fuels. So given that that is the base model for the Tesla, him aligning himself with a voting base that doesn't believe in the climate crisis didn't make sense. So some of this was always going to manifest even outside the Nazi salute. Even outside the Nazi salute, clearly it wasn't a good, like, basic business level decision. That's the first point. The second point as well, in terms of like a general point towards the nature of holding lots of power for long periods of time, is that, especially when it's combined with like a narcissistic personality or a personality that is prone to delusions of grandeur, you can forget that your success is not just a function of your own intelligence and your own hard work and your own innovation, but it's also directly a function of the people around you. Like, I have direct experience of this, where I have seen people, for example, who did very, very well in larger institutions. So when they were working as part of like big investment banks, because they had like hordes and hordes of analysts and associates and like different levels of support at all levels, it basically meant that they did very well in those institutions. However, when they decided to go at it alone, so like found their own businesses, they saw that they didn't achieve the kind of success that they had anticipated. And the reason is very simple. It's based on what I just said. They did well because of the very smart people that supported them in their role. And also because they were part of an institution that had like checks and balances, that had boards that approved decisions, that had committees that approved decisions, that had other people looking at the same problems and coming up with different solutions and essentially like gut checking each other. And because of that infrastructure around these people, they're able to do well in that environment. And the reason why they don't do well in that environment, because now instead of being supported by all those very smart people, they are having to rely on just their own like instincts, their own capabilities, their own intelligence. And it doesn't mean they're not smart. It just means that the recipe for their greatness was also included other people, and they forgot that. Part of the story here with Elon Musk as an industry titan and his downfall is partly explained by the fact that he forgot that the reason why he got to where he was wasn't just on the back of his own capabilities and instincts and intelligence. It was also clearly because of the people and the institutions and the checks and balances around him. Because what we've seen is that when he has taken full reins and he's been front and center and he's been alone at it, we've seen that it's been like a complete shit show. So clearly, he is an example of somebody who does better when he is constrained by the adults in the room, the people who are going to like gut check him, hold him accountable, rein him in, look at the same problem and come up with alternative solutions, and basically essentially just have a cushion around him. He clearly isn't somebody who like can be out there without some level of handholding. Now, going into then why I think Tesla as a company is finished. And when I say finished, I don't think they're going to like file for bankruptcy any day now. I just think that the share price has like a long way to go. And Elon Musk as a personality, as a character, is going to be basically like like Drake in the aftermath of the beef that he had with Kendrick. He'll fade into like slow obscurity. I bet you most people don't even know that Drake released an album like a few weeks ago. And by the way, like it didn't do very well. So I think Elon Musk, as like a public figure, as a celebrity, as a CEO celebrity, he's going to go away slowly until one day he's like an answer to like a trivia question, where like earlier generations won't even remember that at one point he was like the CEO of like a company valued at $1 trillion, like $1 trillion+. And if you think this is far-fetched, like I dare you to tell me who the CEO of Lehman Brothers was before their downfall, or who the CEO of Enron was before their downfall. Like, of course, some people will know because they lived that story in real time, but for the majority of people, like, they won't know. Or the CEO of General Electric. I'm reading a book on General Electric right now. You won't know those names, but there was a time when it would have been inconceivable to not know those people, or those, especially if you're somebody who follows like business news. I think that's what I mean by when I say Tesla as a company is finished, Elon Musk as a persona is finished. Now, the first reason is like what I think I've already spoke about briefly in other episodes, is that like the stock price is down. Now, what's interesting isn't just that the stock price is down, because honestly, like I said, it's been falling for quite a few weeks. I think it's in its ninth consecutive week falling. It's more that it's institutions that are leading the sell-off of Tesla. And the reason why that's meaningful is that it basically means that Wall Street has turned its back on Tesla. And typically what happens in the market is that the big players will define how retail investors and how other investors move. So for example, when Goldman Sachs or JP Morgan or Citigroup or Barclays or any of like the industry titans in the investment world make a prediction about where a stock price is going, typically like the market moves with that information. Typically like the market responds in a way that aligns with the predictions from those big organizations, because we all understand that they have access to information that we don't have, and they also have the ear of many investors, and so we take it as fairly credible information when they move in a specific direction. Now, as far as Tesla is concerned, we have literally seen over the last like week or so major institutions make a prediction about where their stock or their share price is going to go. And as an example, JP Morgan has said that they anticipate their share price will go as low as $120 per share. So as I think I said in the last episode, it was like sitting at $480+ per share back in December 2024. So just like literally three and a half months ago or so. And now it's sitting at $350. So for JP Morgan to say, actually, even though the share price has lost like 50% of its value, we still anticipate it going to as low as $120 per share. That is an example of like the institutions clearly signaling that they have turned against Tesla. So it's very difficult to survive that kind of hit or that kind of a cut. Also, when you look at like the number of people, and by people I mean investors, and by investors I mean mostly institutions who have shorted the stock, literally in the last few weeks, short stocks or like people shorting the stock have made like $16 billion, and they've mostly been institutions. That's basically the market telling you, or the institutions telling you, that we think that future is very dark for Tesla. And it's already, as I said, been revised from a valuation of $1.7 trillion to below $800 billion. They're basically saying it's going to go as low as like $400 billion valuation, which is approximately half, or a little bit more than half. The second reason why they're toast is, you know, if you've gone on Blue Sky or even on his own platform, Twitter, or if you've been like lurking in Reddit comments and posts like I have, or just done like formal research and looked at what the FT has reported on their sales figures, like the sales figures of Tesla, like everywhere you look, like Tesla sales are incredibly down. And by the way, they're down against a backdrop of electric vehicles as a whole going up, which means that it's clearly a Tesla problem as opposed to a electric vehicle problem. To give you a little bit of an indication, and this information, by the way, is a little bit stale. It says it's as of January, so obviously the numbers are higher now, but as of January, sales in Germany, for example, were down 60%. Sales in France were down 63%. Sales in the Netherlands were down 42%. Sales in Norway were down 40%. Sales in Spain were down 75%. Sales in Sweden were down 46%. All of this is to say, like, as far as like European sales go, this is like a complete shit show, a complete disaster. It's very difficult to overcome like sales decline of 75%. And as I said, that information was fresh as of January, so like the numbers are definitely going to be worse. The other reason why they're toast is a few days ago, Elon Musk, Tesla, recalled all Cybertrucks, or virtually all Cybertrucks. They recalled 46,000 Cybertrucks because they're unsafe to drive. Like, I spoke in last week's episode about how, like, components of the car were just literally peeling off as, like, drivers were on the motorway or on the highway, which obviously means that those pieces could, like, fly into the direction of other cars behind them. Basically, like, a massive risk in terms of, like, safety. So they've recalled 46,000 of their Cybertrucks. And by the way, in terms of, like, what I said earlier about an example of somebody who does well as part of an institution, but when they try to do things themselves, like, their own limitations are demonstrated, the Cybertruck is the first car that Elon himself has designed. So all the other vehicles that were designed by, like, engineers with years of experience, years of developing cars and car design, the Cybertruck is the first car that Elon has himself designed. Because as I said in my Elon Musk episode, where I was talking about how he has like fudged his record in terms of like the businesses he's founded. So for example, pretended that he founded Tesla when it had already been running for like 15 years before he came on board as an investor. Or talking about how he founded PayPal when, again, he merged with PayPal. PayPal was a pre-existing business. Just in general, clearly has a chip on his shoulder about his intellect, which is clearly what drives him into making these claims that are not true about his entrepreneurship or his skills in entrepreneurship. So the fact that the first car that he has designed is the car that gets recalled in its entirety speaks volumes in terms of his own capabilities. So you can't recall nearly 50,000 vehicles that all cost about $100,000 each, or between $60,000 and $100,000 each, and not suffer a significant financial loss. And it's worse for Tesla because it's not as though it was a company that was like doing very well, and then they've had like a blip on their record by having to recall all these cars. No, they were already sinking. And then on top of that, nearly 50,000 vehicles have had to be recalled because of safety issues. And to be honest, even that's a misrepresentation of what's going on. It isn't just that like parts of it, as I said last week, of the car was like peeling off. It's also like lots of the functionality didn't work as it should, especially for like a car that costs $100,000. It's like, it doesn't do well off-road, like I said. It doesn't do well in weather, in like cold weather conditions. It isn't even able, for example, like buyers or owners of Cybertrucks in Canada were saying how like the car can't even clear the snow from the windows because the snow is too heavy for the wipers to handle the snow movement, when like the cheapest like Toyota can handle that exertion. Or how like the screens like malfunctioned all the time, about how even like the design of the wheel, where the indicator you flip to indicate you're going left or right, they've replaced that with like the traditional like long spoke thingy to like buttons. So it's like unsafe to try and press these buttons while you're trying to like indicate where you're going. Anyway, point is, in its design, in its construction, in its engineering, it has all of Elon's like sticky, incompetent paws all over it. And because of that, like most of the Cybertrucks have had to be recalled. Again, it's another nail in his coffin, or another nail in the Tesla coffin. And you can tell as well that he clearly is in crisis mode, because we have seen like a couple of things that we've never seen. One, we've seen like a man who went onto the Joe Rogan podcast and talked about how he believed that empathy was weakness, about how the West's biggest weakness was the fact that it was too empathetic towards, like, he was basically speaking about how they're too empathetic towards migrants and immigrants and the more vulnerable people in our communities, and how that is holding back society. Okay, so that guy went on to Fox News, amongst other publications, essentially doing a boohoo about how he was the victim of like this coordinated attack by the left or by Democrats who were trying to bring him and Tesla down. And which is very laughable, first of all, because he fundamentally believes that you can do a Nazi salute on stage and not reap the consequences of those actions. Like, it's not just Democrats, it's not just the left, it's also people in the middle, it's also people on the conservative side. Because just because you're a conservative, it doesn't mean that you're a Nazi or a Nazi a sympathizer. Like, that's the far right. Conservatives can have like conservative beliefs as far as, I don't know, like having a small state, having more libertarian economic and political policies, not believing in an outsized or large social welfare state. You can believe in all those things and not be a right-wing extremist. They're just conservative values. So the idea that he thinks that it's just the left or just Democrats that are against like Nazis is absurd. It's a complete straw man. He's trying to create like this caricature of the person or the people who are against him in a way that neatly fits into like basically Trump's opposition, which just is not true. So the first like indication that he clearly is on major defense is him doing that publicity campaign last week, where he literally spoke, I don't know how many interviews he had, but I couldn't like not see him everywhere I looked, and it was the same sob story that he was trying to sell to the public. The second indication that he is in desperation mode or crisis mode is that we saw Trump do an infomercial on the White House lawn on his behalf. Literally, Trump got like a red Tesla on the White House lawn, and he was sitting in the car talking about all the benefits of the car, how great the car is, how everybody should buy Tesla, about how people are unfairly attacking his buddy Elon. Literally an infomercial, like the president of the United States doing an infomercial for a private corporation on the White House lawn. Like, if that doesn't scream desperation, if that doesn't scream like the idea that he knows that this is like serious like crisis mode, I don't know what else will. Because to me, that's what I thought. I thought like, wow, okay, well, clearly the boycotts are working. Clearly the activism is working. Clearly he's very afraid. Because to be honest, initially when the share price began to nosedive like 8 weeks ago, like he was pretty cocky about it. Like he was like, these kinds of fluctuations in Tesla are expected and normal. And he was like, I'm not concerned at all. And then it went on like another couple of weeks and he still wasn't particularly concerned. And then we saw him starting to like give like speeches in the White House, and that's when I sort of thought like, he's clearly trying to project the fact that he has all this power because he's connected to the president to the point where he can even meet like or have business meetings in the president's Oval Office. He's clearly trying to signal or communicate strength to the markets. But in terms of like the infomercial, in terms of like the media campaign that he had over the last week, in terms of him like having a staff meeting that was broadcast to the public for God knows why, like what reason, having that meeting where he's talking to his staff and he's begging them to not sell their shares in Tesla or to not sell their stock. All those three things are an indication of the fact that the company is in serious distress. And another thing that's compounding the issue to the point where it makes it not just a Tesla problem, but clearly an Elon Musk problem, is that when you look at other areas in his empire, like they are suffering as well. Not to the point that Tesla is suffering, of course, but still, like SpaceX, for example, had a couple of back-to-back setbacks. So one of their rockets exploded last week or 2 weeks ago, and then there had been another such explosion like a month previously. And in light of that, like, Musk did what he always does when things aren't going well, which is to make a claim that, like, greater things are coming in the future for you to ignore what's happening now. So he was like, forget about those two back-to-back explosions. The fact is, we're going to have human beings on Mars by as soon as, like, 2030, which is, like, a... It's such an outsized, grandiose, like, claim that people are so... They're confused. Like, it's such a... Like a... It's such a brave claim that people kind of almost reserve their skepticism, because nobody would be absurd enough to make such a claim. But this is clearly, like, another one of his tactics to distract from the fact that one of his companies isn't doing well, because that's what he does or has been doing with Tesla. Like, one of the ways in which he continually hooks investors back in after disappointing earning calls or disappointing releases of their annual reports is that he says, like, don't focus on the fact that we've just delivered you a turd here. Focus on the fact that, like, in like literally 2 weeks time or 2 months time or a year's time or 3 years time, we're going to have, and then he makes a bigger claim, which is what he just did, like, this last quarter, didn't deliver on any of his earnings targets. And then he was like, well, don't worry about it, because we're going to have fully self-driving vehicles in like a couple of months. By June, July, this summer, we're going to have fully self-driving cars. Now, the reason why that's like an outrageous claim for Elon Musk to make is because he's been promising fully self-driving cars since 2015. So it's unclear why, if you haven't been able to deliver it in the last decade, you're going to be able to deliver it in like 6 months time on the... on the back of like an incredibly disappointing quarter. And to be honest, not just quarter, but like at this stage, like I said, I think it's going to be a prolonged disappointment. So again, like with the SpaceX, him pointing to the fact that he's going to have people on Mars in as early as the 2030s is an example of like throwing a dead cat on the table to distract you from the fact that things aren't going well. Other things not going well is as far as his Starlink business is concerned, which is his satellite internet service company. It's not going well because the European Union as a bloc are trying to move away from over-dependence on Starlink because they view him as a US risk. They basically don't distinguish or delineate between like the just sheer volatility and unpredictability of the US administration. They don't distinguish between US administration policies any longer with Elon Musk's private businesses. So they kind of see them as two in the same. And because what we have observed, especially in this second term with Trump, is that just that it's impossible to rely on him as a trading partner, as demonstrated by how he's behaved with Canada and Mexico and other Latin American countries or countries in the Americas. And also some of the threats that he's levied against the European Union, who have been sort of one of their strongest military and trade allies since World War II. Like, a lot of countries are trying to move away from what they consider is US risk. And now, because Elon Musk is so deeply ingrained in the US administration with his work, quote unquote, with Doge, they essentially see US risk and Elon risk as the same thing. So what the European Union has been trying to do is they're trying to pivot away from dependence on Starlink, and they want to start introducing or also relying more heavily on this their competitor, which is Eutelsat. Might be pronouncing that wrong, but all of this to say is that as far as SpaceX, as far as Starlink, like all these things are interconnected. It's not as though like you can have an empire in which like three out of the four massive pillars of your empire aren't doing well or they're on shaky grounds and think that you're going to have an overall successful picture. Like the four pillars are fundamentally on shaky grounds. Obviously, the one on shakiest ground of all is Tesla and Twitter. Speaking of Twitter, I was incredibly surprised to see like an article that said that Twitter's valuation was back to its $44 billion. So in case you don't remember, Elon Musk bought it like 4 years ago or so, and he bought it for $44 billion. And a lot of people consider that to have been an overpayment, like a massive overpayment. And initially, he actually tried to renege out of the deal because he realized too late after he'd signed everything that he was overpaying or that he had been bamboozled into overpaying. But legally he couldn't get out of it. So he overpaid by $44 billion, and shortly after, Fidelity, which is one of their biggest investors, like, wrote off their investment by like 60 to 70%. I forget exactly what value they wrote down their investment by, but it was a huge chunk. It was basically saying like, yeah, he's destroyed the value of Twitter. Long story short, it ended up being valued at one period for $9 billion. So it had lost like $35 billion off its initial purchase price. So anyway, the reason I was surprised was that last time I had heard, it was worth or valued at $9 billion. And then like now out of the blue, it's worth exactly the same amount he paid for it. Despite the fact that we know that that is literally impossible. If you consider like the basic metrics of what the business model for Twitter is, it's an advertising business that harnesses user data, which means you need to have advertisers on your platform, and you also have to have lots of users so that advertisers can advertise to. On both those fronts, Twitter has been suffering. Like, as we know, there's been a massive exodus of users who are turned off by the fact that the site has been turned into like an extremist, like, right-wing platform with like a deluge of just porn everywhere. I went on it like a few weeks ago and I was trying to read just a regular article on, what was I reading on? It was on people, like Trump supporters who basically had voted for Trump, and in all kinds of ways, like, things weren't working out for them. Like, there were farmers, for example, who voted against their own interests by voting for Trump, only to realize that they received subsidies from the government for their farming that under the Trump administration they were no longer going to get, and that was resulting in financial distress for them. So I was on Twitter reading an article about that, and all of a sudden below that it was just porn everywhere. And it wasn't even like the Instagram teasing porn where it's kind of like a woman who's in a bikini and she's like, you know, she's like on a beach posing suggestively, and then you have to click to her website and then that takes you to like some kind of porn site. It wasn't even that. It was just like straight up porn stuff. Long story short, unclear how a platform that's just been degraded in terms of like the quality of the conversations, the fact that lots of people have left, the fact that advertisers just see it as a massive risk to advertise in the platform because they don't know if they're going to be find themselves like in between like a post that features pornography or a post that features a far right extremism. It's just like a brand risk for them. Although some have come back, but nowhere near what they were pre the purchase of Twitter. So again, given that we know all that stuff, how in the hell is it valued at $44 billion now? Because none of those core business model features or components have changed. Users haven't increased. Advertisers haven't returned to the same level. And so at the very best, let's say even if we said that there has been a return of some advertisers, because there have been, but it hasn't been to the same degree, and the number of users are still lower, then we should see that maybe it's gone from like the $9 billion valuation it had after it had purchased Twitter to like something more modest, like 20 maybe, or 15, or even like 30. But for it to be exactly dollar for dollar back to the same valuation clearly is like highly, highly suspicious. Now, when you dig a little bit deeper, you realize that the reason why it's been valued back at $44 billion is because Elon has given his investor base a stake in his other business, which is XAI, his artificial intelligence business. He's given them a 25% stake, which basically has allowed them to claim that the valuation of Twitter is back to $44 billion, which clearly is like not true. Even with that 25% stake, it's not true. And really all we can say about this, because with the fullness of time, you know, lies like this usually crumble upon further investigation, especially when like proper financial investigators or journalists start sort of pulling those threads, it will be revealed that it's not actually worth or truly now valued at $44 billion again. It kind of reminds me of Enron, like the massive energy company. To be honest, Enron did so much at the end, but it reminds me of Enron and how they were able to hide their financial losses by pulling clever accounting tricks as well. And one of the ways in which they achieved like higher valuations year on year, despite the fact that there was like massive holes in their finances, was that they were basically like claiming future profits for now. So they would like look into their magic ball and they would be like, well, we think that in 2035, we're going to make $50 billion. So why don't we just pretend like we already have made that much money? So they would declare future earnings as today. And so for a long time, like people, and they would do it in a clever way. It wasn't that it's like, you couldn't look at their accounts and see that that was going on. It had to be through the digging of investigators where they traced where the numbers were actually coming from. And it turned out they were just like literally magicking up numbers. I don't know if like Twitter will be as bad as that, but clearly you cannot go from a valuation of 9 billion when you've lost all your use, like all your, or many of your advertisers, and the user base has just completely decreased and the engagement level is completely decreased, and then claim that the valuation is still at the same level. Clearly there's some trickery going on. So I personally am excited to see what the truth is as time goes on. Speaking of dodgy behavior, the other thing that I saw that made me think like, like this, I don't know, this seems like funny. So I saw like this video where it must have been like 100 Teslas parked in one parking lot. And every single one of those Teslas had been defaced. Somebody had written like swastika and a Nazi symbol on every single one of those cars. And the thing that stood out to me about those cars was like, why would like millions and millions and millions of dollars worth of vehicles be unsupervised in an outdoor parking lot? That's number one, with no security, like, yeah, clearly no security patrolling the area or keeping watch, and still remaining outside in after hours. Like, I could understand that maybe for like a regular company that isn't going through the sheer political turmoil and like activism truly that Tesla is facing. But if I was like CEO of Tesla and I had already seen that other cars, like people who own Cybertrucks, for example, or own Model Ys and Model 3s, or own like other Tesla vehicles, if I had seen that they on the streets are getting vandalized, there's no way I would leave like millions and millions and millions of dollars worth of cars parked outside unsupervised with no security whatsoever. To me, that automatically felt or smelled like they're trying to recoup some of the costs that they've spent or some of the costs that they've lost on the Cybertruck by claiming on insurance, because if they can't shift the cars, because if you look at some of the images as well, by the way, of their stocks, he had projected that he was going to sell like hundreds of thousands of these vehicles. And to date, like the numbers have been incredibly disappointing. So one of the ways in which you can recoup some of your costs is if they are magically damaged, all of them. And then the insurance basically has to pay out, and you're not going to get all the money you could have gotten if you had sold the cars, obviously, but it's still a decent chunk of change for products that you otherwise wouldn't have moved. So I saw that video and I was like, something about the smells off, but that's just my sheer speculation. The other thing that isn't my sheer speculation is that the Financial Times released an article or a report in which they identified $1.5 billion that had gone missing from Tesla's accounts. So they compared, they analyzed their statements, and they looked at how much they had said they were going to spend on CapEx, on capital expenditure. And then when they tried to find or trace the money, they realized that they had said they were going to spend like X, but they spent X minus 1.5 billion essentially. And that 1.5 billion is a huge sum of money to not be accounted for. Basically, the implication is that there is some funny accounting tricks that go on within Tesla as a company. And this is like either a slip in which they have forgotten to like reconcile the statements so that that trickery is like disguised, or there's just like some form of like out and out corruption or theft going on. Now, the information I've just given over the past like 39 minutes or so is only a fraction of the information that's out there. All this information is freely available for anybody interested. Like, none of it is behind a paywall. And retail investors presumably will have read or seen or been privy to like all of this information and probably more, to tell you the truth. Like, people who are actively trade stocks tend to sort of be obsessed with the stocks that they trade in. So presumably Tesla investors like wake up reading Tesla news and go to sleep reading Tesla news, and in general keep a close ear to the ground. All this information is overwhelmingly negative, and not just negative as like a temporary blip, because sometimes it's like a negative news cycle that has an impact on the stock price of like a company that you're interested in, and that doesn't mean that you divest fully, because again, it's like a short news cycle. Like, a CEO gets caught in a scandal, and sometimes that might last like a few days, sometimes that might last like a few weeks, but usually it isn't like enough for you to be like, I'm divesting from this company. This is not what's going on with Tesla, as I've just spent time describing. This is like at every level of his empire, at like every pillar of his empire is like under threat on shaky grounds. Tesla, Twitter, SpaceX, Starlink. I didn't talk about XAI because I honestly don't know much about that side of his business. But as far as those four pillars, like, you can't look at them and think that they're in a good spot, with the exception of SpaceX, because they are partnered with NASA, and as long as they continue to be partnered and they have that partnership, they're going to continue to get government money, essentially. And on top of that, NASA really has done most of the heavy lifting. So like, as far as that side of his business, even though he's had a couple of like setbacks, I don't see that side of the business going away for a very long time, just because of that partnership and that government money. But the other pillars, like, it is negative in the short term, it's negative in the medium term. And as far as I'm concerned, and as far as like many people are concerned now, as far as Tesla is concerned, in the long term, it doesn't look good at all. And so then my question, or my point of it, of this discussion is, like, given all that negative information that's out there, freely available, why is it coinciding with the phenomenon, sorry, that's my alarm, with the phenomenon that we're seeing right now, which is retail investors are like investing in Tesla at the highest ever level on record. Like, despite the fact that institutional money is on its way out, lots of investors have come out and spoken, like institutional investors have come out and spoken publicly against Tesla and said that the only way they see Tesla surviving is if Elon Musk steps down. Despite the sales information that I've given you that's widely reported, despite the fact that some of his like long-term investors, including his own family members, have sold the stock, why is it that retail investors are still looking at it as a good potential investment? The first reason, I think, is people, like, in general, fall prey to the idea of sunk cost fallacy, where they, when they have spent money on something, they don't want to walk away. They find it difficult to walk away because walking away means that they crystallize their losses, or it means accepting the fact that the money that they spent, the money that they invested in this case, isn't going to come back to them. So for people who like invested shortly before Tesla started to nosedive, like, they're trying to get their money back. They believe that that money wasn't wasted. They believe that there's some way out of this like complete shit show. Other people who bought in much earlier, so let's say they bought in when Tesla was like $180, they have tasted the sweet, sweet highs of like 480, 488, 485. And so for them, for the stock to now be at like 270 or so, I think I had said somewhere else it was like 350, but it's actually 270, 275 right now. So for them to have been at 488 and then now at being at 275, and having bought it at 180, they just hope that they can recoup some of those profits. So they're not in the red, like they haven't lost money on Tesla, but they've lost some of the upside, some of the profits from earlier months. And they're just hoping against hope that they can recoup some of those profits. So a lot of it is just basic human like difficulty in accepting like sunk costs. The idea that you should sometimes just walk away from something because it's not going to get any better. And it doesn't matter how long you stay, you're not going to recoup how much money you have because, again, like, it's at the bottom or it's going even lower. Outside sunk cost fallacy, I think people believe that they are buying the dip. So they believe that they're buying a share or a stock at a low price than it traditionally is. And it's a good buying opportunity because, again, they foresee the price going up again. So they think it's a momentary dip. And if they buy the dip, they can be like along the ride for when it goes back to 480 or 300 or 350 or whatever it may be. So it's kind of like that, you know, like there's some investment advice that's just like known to everybody, even if they're not investors. An example is diversifying. Everybody knows that you should diversify. You shouldn't put all your eggs in one basket. You should buy different types of stocks from different types of industries and sectors because you don't want to risk losing all your money, essentially. If let's say all you do is buy tech stocks. If the tech industry, for whatever reason, goes down or experiences a recession or a crisis, it means you're going to lose all your money. Whereas if you are invested in like some defense stocks or some retail or some other types of industries, it means that even if tech stocks like nosedive completely, as they did like a few weeks ago, you still have other income from the other industries you've invested in. So the idea of diversifying your portfolio or your investment is like, just has made it into the public domain. Another one of those things that have made it into the public domain is buying the dip. The idea that there are stocks that are typically very, very expensive, but they're very resilient businesses. And so if they should experience a temporary shock that causes their price to go down, you should like rush in there and buy it as a once in a lifetime opportunity to buy at a lower price because the natural tendency of this stock is to be higher. So they essentially think that the natural tendency of Tesla is to be high. And right now they're taking advantage of a sale, essentially. The third reason is that a lot of people have bought into the cult of personality that is Elon Musk. Like a lot of people won't necessarily know much about him. They won't know his like educational background. They won't know about his familial background. They won't really know much about electric vehicles or cars or space exploration. They won't have an in-depth understanding or interest in his businesses, but they have an in-depth interest in him as a person, you know? So it's sort of like whatever he says, like runs with them because it's not really about his businesses. It's more that they're enamored by his persona. It's like, he represents something to them. He represents like the alpha male who is smart, who is an intelligent investor, who's like business savvy, who gets lots of women, who has lots of money, who's very powerful in all these different ways. And so for them, like whatever Elon says goes or runs, because what they're invested in is not so much Elon's businesses, it's more Elon as a person. Not even as a person, more of like Elon as an idea. Another reason why I think retailers are still buying Tesla stock is, and I mean this with the utmost respect, I think a lot of them are like not that financially literate. And by that I mean like they remind me a lot of like crypto bros who on the one hand like love the idea of crypto because for them it represents like freedom from like an oppressive state. So the idea that every transaction is monitored by the government through the financial institutions that they bank with. They love the idea of being able to transact away from Big Brother. So they love the idea of crypto because it allows them to do so. Like they can make purchases, make decisions, and those decisions don't go towards like a file on them on some server that the bank holds and therefore that the government has access to. But whilst they're interested in this general idea of liberation from like the surveillance state or even just from like corporate surveillance, you know, the idea that your purchasing habits are always being tracked and monitored and stored by corporations, especially banks that literally have every single transaction you've ever made on your card, like they have that and they use that information. So like crypto bros are interested in that idea of just being able to transact anonymously, being able to transact without your data being collected, being able to transact without you being surveyed. They combine that with the idea that not only are they getting that out of crypto, which, you know, it is true, they are getting that, they also then make a claim that it's also like a financial investment, that's an investment in general, it's an asset class in its own right, and that it's going to see like massive upside in the future. And Like, that couldn't be further from the truth. I'm sorry. Like, it's clearly a Ponzi scheme, because the way that crypto and other, like, crypto in general makes money is that the price or the value of the crypto goes up if more people believe that it's going to go up, which is very different from traditional, like, legitimate businesses where the price goes up when they've had successes. So, for example, when they enter new markets and they do well, or when they form partnerships that results in them making more money, then usually the share price follows along. Similarly, when bad things happen in the market and they lose money, the share price goes down. So the share price movement isn't based on how people feel about, like, the stock. It's based on, like, real commerce, real business, real transactions. Whereas with crypto, it's literally based on people's warm and fuzzies. If people have the utmost belief that Bitcoin is going to be here for the future, then it's going to do well. But you'll notice when it experiences massive fluctuations, it's not because anything has happened in the market, like in the economy. Sometimes the economy is completely stable, but for whatever reason, something has shaken the quote-unquote investors or buyers of Bitcoin, and then that shaking up or that, like, falter in their belief itself causes the value of the Bitcoin to go down. That's very different. That's a fundamental difference to, like, real businesses or real, like, public companies that are listed on the exchange that do well or fall on the basis of how their business is doing. Anyway, going back to the financial literacy point, like, many crypto, like, bros don't understand that basic premise. And to be honest, even outside that basic premise of, like, the technology point, they also aren't interested in finances or finance as a concept, because one of the things that I have come across from the crypto, like, investors, quote unquote, that I've met, is that they will have no interest in reading, like, a financial paper or reading anything to do with economics or finances or markets or commerce. Like, they won't have the time for it, because it's just betting for them. It's like they'll buy, like, coins at, like, not one of a pence or a penny or a cent, and then they hope that it'll go up to, like, a penny or a pound or a euro or a dollar. It's pure speculation, to the point where, like, you know, somebody I know was, like, showing me their online wallet of all these crypto assets that they had, and he was showing me how he goes about choosing, like, which crypto assets, quote unquote, that he invests in. And as he was, like, he clicked on, like, a number of them, and he was like, so here's the price, you can see, like, their previous performance in, like, a chart, and they can read some information on them. But then he revealed to me, he was like, but I never read that. Like, he was like, I don't like to read, like, the description of the company or the coin. I don't like to, he doesn't like to read, like, the historical financial data. So if you're not looking at the historical financial data, but you're investing in something, quote unquote, then you're just betting. And I think that that's what's happening with the Tesla stock as well, in that clearly a lot of retail investors, if they're looking at, like, just this deluge of negative information coming from all sources, from all angles, not just, like, other retailers that have gotten out, but also, like, institutional investors, also just, like, political commentators on the left and the right, conservative, non-conservative, like, the news is pretty, like, unrelenting, and it has been for, like, months now. The fact that they can look at all that information, and despite all that information, and also the fact that they missed their earnings call, despite the fact that they've missed their targets. So, for example, the fully self-driving target that's been promised since 2015, and all the other disappointments, the cyber trucks that I spoke about, like, literally, like, just the negative press is honestly, like I said, unrelenting. The fact that retail investors look at all that information and still choose to buy Tesla stock in this climate clearly tell you that it's like there's some level of financial illiteracy taking place, clearly, or there's some type of feeling that is overriding their critical thinking faculties and their instincts for self-preservation. The final reason I think people are investing in Tesla, despite sort of, like, just all the information about it going down and the fact that it has already experienced so much loss in the last few weeks and months, is I think what many people see in the uber wealthy, like Elon Musk or Bill Gates or Jeff Bezos. The reason why they're so committed to these people and to the idea of these people and their businesses, and are therefore willing to support them even when all evidence shows or points in the opposite direction that they should be running for the hills. The reason why they do so is because they are incredibly invested in the idea that the American dream is alive and well. And these uber wealthy people kind of like prove this, you know? So they might be looking around their lives and they might not be in a good financial spot. They might not have generational wealth. They might not have businesses. They might be struggling financially to support themselves and their families. Or they might have all these debts from like student loans, but they can still hang on to the idea that they can make it one day by looking at these figures like Elon Musk, where they might not know intimately like about what their businesses are or what is going on fully in terms of like the political environment and sphere in which Tesla and Elon Musk and his businesses are operating under. But he, Elon Musk, for example, is like a shorthand for like, it is possible to make it in America. It's possible to be born with nothing and make money. That's why, for example, like even like the wealthiest of people will always claim they were born with nothing, like Drake, you know, like clearly upper middle class boy, but will claim that he started from the bottom, but now he's here. Or Elon Musk being somebody who like inherited colonial money, like millions of dollars, millions of rands, hundreds of millions of rands from the colonial era, from apartheid, but still claim that he like made it by himself. The reason why they cling onto that narrative, or celebrities like actors, like why is it like every actor like started with nothing? Even when you can tell that that's just blatantly not true, it's because they know that in the public's imagination, they will always root for the underdog. Nobody likes to root for somebody who was born with a silver spoon in their mouth and still has a silver spoon and is still reaping the benefits of having been born lucky enough to be born in a wealthy family. So again, like part of the rationale of why like people have made Tesla a meme stock and have continued to invest in Tesla, even as the institutions are leaving, even as the world is literally turning against the company and the founder, not founder, that's giving too much credit, and the CEO and his other businesses, is because like, we recognize that it's a sinking ship. And the reason why there's this cognitive dissonance between like the rest of the population that sees it for what it is and the population that continues to buy into like this failing company is because those investors in Tesla, those retail investors in Tesla, are like deeply committed to the American dream as embodied in Elon Musk being true. And for them, like his downfall kind of represents the death of that dream. So clearly they're willing to hang on to it to the very last dime. Now the final bit I'll talk about, and I had planned on speaking about this at length, but instead I'll just make it a couple of sentences. And that is on like why retail investors are going to be the biggest losers, or put another way, why they're not going to beat what institutional investors have predicted is going to happen. So institutional investors are turning away from Tesla because they anticipate this, the share price like decreasing to as low as $120 per share, maybe even lower, depending on how like things go politically as well for the US administration and for Trump's administration. And so right now there's a battle between retail investors and institutional investors. Institutional investors betting that it's going to go down, Tesla's going to go down, and retail investors continuing to buy the dip, quote unquote, believing that Tesla is going to recoup its value, both in the short term, medium term, and long term. And the reason why institutions always win, and when I say always win, I mean like literally always without exception, is because one, they have like incredibly more power across every metric, like across every avenue you can think of. So one, they have more money. So they've got more money in terms of like the money that they have as a house or as an organization is going to be significantly higher. Like imagine the average person and how much money they're working with. It's probably money from their savings or money that they've borrowed from friends. Hopefully that's not the case, but sometimes people do that. or maybe they're using some money they inherited from a family member. But either way, it's always going to be peanuts in comparison to institutional investors or institutional money that is literally in the trillions of dollars. Like organizations like JP Morgan or Goldman Sachs or Citigroup or Barclays, like they have access to not billions of dollars, trillions of dollars. And even when they don't have the money themselves in-house, they can borrow or pool with other investors or other investment houses and basically multiply the amount of money they have. And if they have to borrow money, because many of them do borrow money to invest, then they're doing it on really, really competitive, attractive terms. So the rates that borrowers, that our institutions get versus the rates that individuals get are just like night and day. Even when I used to raise capital for businesses, one of the things that really shocked me was how little interest they could pay. So once, for example, we raised money for a country, like was a sovereign capital raising, and they paid, like the interest they paid on the money they raised, and I won't give you the exact sum, but let's say hypothetically they raised like $300 billion, they paid like a percentage point on that. Whereas for the average consumer loan, it's going to be significantly higher than 1%. They might be paying like 5%, 7%, 15%. Like your overdraft alone, like your overdraft that you have at your bank, with your bank, if you look at it, it's going to be incredibly predatory. It's going to be like 24%, 25%, 19%. Because again, like retailers versus investors or institutions get treated very differently. And so as far as sort of like Tesla is concerned, like they, like institutions have bottomless pits of money to spend on their positions or to spend on how they predict the stock to move. So even if they should experience losses, like in the short term, they're going to hang on to those predictions until the very end. And they've got the sustainability that comes from having deep pockets to hold on to those losses. Because the average person, if they invest money and they lose like 20, 30%, like they are getting out of that position, they're divesting. Whereas like institutions exist for lifetimes, for decades. And so if it's required, they can hold on to that for like 100 years, 50 years, 20 years, 5 years. They can afford to hold on to those losses for a very long time until their prediction becomes true. Whereas clearly like retail investors, like their horizon or their ability to hang on to losses or to see losses through like rough periods, especially when there are sustained long periods of time, is like much more limited. So again, like in a fight between like bottomless money that can hang on for as long as it takes versus like retailers with shallow pockets that can't afford to be in the market and sustain losses for longer, like chances are the institutions are clearly in a better position. Another thing that means that retailers are going to lose, as they always do when they go against institutions, is that institutions have access to like bottomless research. They have teams of analysts that are literally working 24/7, that are factoring in every piece of information you can imagine, like the sentiment around the CEO, the sentiment around the company, the historical information going back as long as it takes, the economic information, the regulatory information, the market information, like the input from other investors and how they intend on moving. Like they have access to like thousands and thousands and thousands of data points that are up to date, that they receive in real time, and that they build into like sophisticated models, even outside the manual research and work that analysts and associates engage in. They also are trading using artificial intelligence, using algorithms, using like all kinds of sophisticated tools that retailers don't have access to, don't have the time, and don't have the access to. For example, like one of the best tools you can use for investment research is a Bloomberg terminal, and each terminal costs something like $24,000 to $25,000. Like the average retailer cannot afford afford that, which means that the major source of information that's required, that's accessed through this terminal, through the Bloomberg terminal, is never accessible to them, which means every single item of information they receive, they're always receiving it a day late and a dollar short, because that's the nature of information. It's valuable the sooner you get it. The more publications it has to go through and the longer time it takes to reach you, the less valuable that it is. So institutions like £24,000, $24,000 for a terminal, a Bloomberg terminal, it's chump change to them. They've got thousands of those terminals, and they've got thousands, hundreds of thousands of analysts and associates working on those terminals, like conducting research, having like private calls and meetings with other investors who also invest in Tesla. So when they form a view, that view isn't just based on like their warm and feelies. That view is highly, highly well informed in a way where the retail investors just can never compete. That's why a lot of like individual like investors, their strategy is just to copy what like large institutions are doing, because they know that the large institutions are not going to act against their own interest. They have access to superior information, superior research, and superior resources in every way you can imagine. And so they just follow their movements, essentially. Again, like retailers choosing to go against like these mammoths of institutions and their power and resourcefulness and resources and research and access and money, like clearly a fool's errand. And by the way, like there are parallels in recent history that we can draw like deductions from what's likely going to happen with Tesla. Think of GameStop, like the GameStop era, where retailers essentially, again, were going against institutions. Like retailers were trying to defend GameStop as a stock and as a company. And despite the fact that 63% of institutional investors were shorting the stock, i.e. they were making bets that GameStop was like gonna go down, retail investors were like buying the dip as they're doing so right now with Tesla. Like they were pumping large amounts of money into GameStop, despite the fact that all the indicators were pointing to the fact that this company was going to nosedive off of like off the chart or off the planet, basically. And what happened was interesting, because initially, like the stock went up. So I was looking at the timeline earlier, actually, and it's really interesting stuff. What happened with GameStop was that in January 2019, the shares, like each share traded for like $3.97. Let's call it $4. Then in July 2019, like Bloomberg made the announcement that 63% of the company's outstanding shares were being sold short. So they're being shorted, which basically is a message to the market that this company is going down, because 63% of people are betting against the company. So it's basically toast. However, between August 2019 and like March 2021, like the stock continued to rise. Like GameStop's price went from like $4 or $3.97 to $40, then $50, then $65. At one point, it peaked at like $500 per share. And this, again, is from a growth of $3.97, a mere like 2 years to the nose earlier. So clearly, like, something crazy is happening, because the company has not grown that much in that short amount of period. It's clearly was a consequence of retailers like hoping against hope, taking a bet against the institutions, and temporarily they were winning because the share price was going up and up and up and up. What happens is Robinhood, which was the platform on which GameStop was traded, ends up basically preventing buyers or retail investors from continuing to buy the stock. So they basically turn off the buy function, which means that the only function left is the sell function, the short function. And what happened was like the stock nosedived. It went from like a peak of $500 to today, like I checked this morning before recording this episode, the stock is now worth $24. And that was 4 years ago now. So clearly it isn't going to rebound back to $500. And if it does do so, it probably isn't going to be like anytime soon, if ever, to tell you the truth. Companies don't tend to make to recover from like that steep of a loss from $500 to $24. Like that's kind of like game over. Not game over that the company is going to like stop trading necessarily, but it's just very, very unlikely to go back to $500 per share. Like when you look at Tesla and the profile and the news and the predictions and the groups that are at war between the retailers and the institutions, like it's even worse than GameStop, because GameStop, at the very least, it was like a group of activist retailers who were like determined to band together to save like a beloved company, like games company. This is an uglier beast because there's no redemption story in the Tesla story, because it's not even as though you're betting for the underdog. You're betting for like a colonial era villain whose father has had a child with his stepsister, the daughter which the father had raised for like 20 years. Elon himself has like 14 kids and counting, because he believes in the great replacement theory, where he thinks that white people are being replaced by people of color. And so he's taken it on as his personal mission to have like as many children as possible. And he has like four or five baby moms at this point. On top of that, he's a man who did the Nazi salute at the inauguration of the most recent US president. On top of that, his company itself is like a complete disappointment in terms of like what it has promised and what it has achieved. Like, he's a fraud at every level. If you listen to my episode on Elon Musk, when I talk about all the lies that he has told about his track record as an innovator and an engineer and business owner, like there's no redemptive story that like activist investors can rally behind and be and feel like they're saving like the underdog. Like, this is a villain, an ugly villain in terms of like his beliefs, the things he's done, the things he has said. Ugh, like at every single level, it's honestly like I said, it's toast. Anyway, I'm going to wrap up this episode there. All I can say for retail investors is, like, learn from the GameStop saga. Like, there are so many parallels, like I said, so many lessons to be learned. And honestly, if you look at, like, do, like, a historical research on times at which retail investors have gone against institutional investors, and you'll find the results very sobering, because you will see that in no circumstances have they ever won beyond like the short term, beyond like a few months, or maybe even a year. I think it was for GameStop, or a year or two. Like, the house always wins in the long run. Like, the institutions always win in the long run. And so you might as well save yourself some money and get out now while you can, because you can just get out now and wait to see where it goes in a few weeks time. You know, like, if you think that things are going to change, like, maybe wait till the April 29. I think it's April 29 is when they release the next quarterly, like, next quarterly account. And apparently that's going to be a bloodbath. Like, apparently it is going to be terrible, because we've all seen some of the sales information around from Europe, from China, from California, and other places in the US. So we all know, like, the sales are terrible, but we haven't seen it written black and white, accounted by the company, like in graphical terms. So at least as retail investors, like, take your money out now and wait until after the April 29, like, quarterly reports have been released. Wait a few weeks, see where the wind blows. And then if for some miracle, like, the share price continues to increase, then, like, maybe buy in then. But right now, like, I tell you for free, like, the future is dark for Tesla. So I'm going to wrap up this week's episode there. Thank you so much for tuning in. I hope you enjoyed the episode. If you did enjoy the episode and were able to listen to the very end, I'd love for you to send me any interesting comments or articles or opinions you might have, and I will engage with them by email. My email is in the show notes. I think last week I called out the wrong email address when I was saying it at the very end, so just look at the show notes. It's always there above the articles section. If you like the episode and want to support me in some way, I would love for you to leave me a positive review wherever you get your podcasts from, whether it's on Spotify or Apple or Google or somewhere else. That'll be very helpful in helping other people find the episode. Until next week, have a great week, and I'll speak to you then.